Hello, I'm Bruce Celery. This is Moolala, Money Made Simple, relationships and money. If it feels like sometimes you and your partner just can't figure out how to get a handle on your finances together, it might have something to do with your history, your past, your attachment style, to be exact. Ed Combs is a certified financial planner. He's also a registered therapist, master's degree in counseling. And he's here to talk about some insight from his book, The Healthy Love and Money Way, how the four attachment styles impact your financial well-being. And the latest trends when it comes to fraud. Yeah, I wish I was talking about fashion, but I am not. The fraudsters are up to all sorts of innovation, and Julie Kuznick will be here to talk about what she has learned. She is with Equifax Canada. She has some ideas on tips to minimize the risk that you will be a victim of identity theft. Then, wow, raising a child these days is super duper expensive. If you're a new parent, you probably received some gifts, and maybe, just maybe, you wish you'd received cash instead. Scarlett Lee Gossock is the CEO of GiftStart, and she's here to talk about its cash fund feature. So you can actually register to receive cash for something that would make a really big difference for your kid. Plus, calling all prospective home buyers. I don't know if the property you're looking into has a troublesome past. Clay Jarvis, NerdWallet Canada's real estate and financial expert, is here to share his tips and tell us how that could impact your property, your home's property value, if you buy one with a history. This is Moolala, Money Made Simple, brought to you in part by Credit Canada, the first and longest standing nonprofit credit counseling agency in the country, and by MNP Debt, specializing in personal bankruptcy, consumer proposals, and debt help. Let's get started. For people in relationships, and what I mean is like partner relationship, not like the relationship with you have with the person who delivers your newspaper or something like that, but intimate relationships. I think we could all say, or we could all agree, that it is really important to talk about money. Sometimes you may not see eye to eye on what to do, how to spend, how to save. And a part of that conflict, a part of that tension, could be grounded in your past and something called your attachment style. Ed Combs is both a certified financial planner and a therapist, and he works with couples to help them understand how their attachment styles can impact their shared financial life. He is the author of The Healthy Love and Money Way, How the Four Attachment Styles Impact Your Financial Well-Being. He joins us now from Charlotte, North Carolina. Hello there.
Hi, Bruce. Thanks so much for having me on today.
It is our pleasure. Financial planner and therapist. That's like doctor, lawyer, or I don't know, any other peanut butter and jelly. How do those two go together? And which came first?
You know, I appreciate the peanut butter and jelly reference, considering I just had one for lunch.
Oh, nice.
So speaking of psychology, it's just a throwback to a childhood need, right? Peanut butter and jelly is a classic staple. Yeah. But really, right, financial planning and therapy, most people actually almost instinctively get it, like, oh yeah, no duh, why aren't those things together? But the reality is, when we're trying to make decisions for our financial life and make plans for the future, it would be nice if we were a blank slate when we met with a financial planner and we're just wide open and bushy-eyed to their recommendations. But the reality is, no, we have lots of life experiences that have shaped our psychological makeup, shaped our brain functioning. And so therapists are really all the experts at both understanding how our psychological makeup is wired, but also more importantly, how do we change? How do we heal, especially when there's pain associated with something, psychologically speaking?
I love a quiz, and you have a quiz on your website. So I did the quiz. I did all the little things, the questions of the quiz. It was very cosmopolitan 2004. Can you give people a flavor of what you're asking and what you're helping them to identify?
Yeah. So my big interest is the psychology of attachment, and there's four attachment styles that the research has borne. And so in this quiz, what we're trying to identify is, do you generally experience secure attachment, anxious attachment, avoidant attachment, or disorganized attachment? So we're asking questions like, I feel really comfortable talking with my intimate partner about money. And, you know, depending on how you answer that question, you have option A, yes, I love talking to my partner about money. Okay, you're probably secure. I get really overwhelmed talking to my partner about money. Okay, maybe anxious. I don't think it's any of my partner's business talking money with them. Maybe more avoidant, right? So we're using different questions to try to help get, see where you might feel fit in that relational category.
When I hear the word attachment, I immediately go back to my, you know, parenting experience, parenting a child who was adopted. Attachment's a very big idea. How far back do you go with people to help them understand the roots of that attachment style?
That's a great question. So we do go all the way back to infancy, childbirth experiences, parental expectations about receiving you in, and the bonding experience. Have worked with a number of adopted children in the process, and certainly that relational experience is a profound base, psychologically speaking. And then typically what we also do is we start to talk about kind of intergenerationally or multi-generational. What I have clients reflect on, what do you think your parents' attachment style was? What do you think led to that for them? And so, you know, it becomes less of this mystery of like, why am I the way I am? Why do I experience relationships the way that I do? You know, getting that insight, then it leads to like, well, okay, now what do I do in light of that? How do I start to help my psychological makeup move towards more of a secure way of relating?
When I hear the phrase attachment style, it feels very much like an is, like a preference for chocolate ice cream. It is an is. I'm not particularly interested in vanilla. I'm not interested in learning about vanilla. I am left-handed. It is an is. My sense is, though, based on what I've read of you and your work, is there is some evolution or some progress that can be made on understanding attachment styles and having them work more effectively to mitigate the anxiety or the avoidance. How does that work?
Yeah, that's a great question. Well, because attachment styles is looking at relational history, and our brain is a relationship organ. So when we give our brain new relational experiences that are healthy, balanced, reflective, empathic, our brain actually starts to rewire itself and recognize new relational patterns as being satisfying and gratifying, as being regulating. And so we don't pick our particular attachment style, but when we can get in a therapeutic relationship that helps us have new relational experiences that represent more secure patterns, our brain will grow and change, as well as our nervous system, because they're all so deeply interconnected. So no, we don't pick it, but we can help it evolve with intention.
The couple comes into your room, into your space, and maybe it's Zoom and maybe it's in person, I don't know.
It's all Zoom.
Okay. So they're coming into your Zoom room. How would you characterize what that first meeting is like, knowing that every single couple is completely different, but there must be a through line there of like, yep, I know how this goes.
Yeah, there is absolutely a through line. And so one of the first things I'm doing with clients or even people that are checking me out is I'm asking a lot of questions about their family history, their experiences with money. And what happens in that storytelling oftentimes is not always that new details come out, but deeper levels of emotional understanding and meaning come out. And for most couples, that starts to evoke more compassion, where there's anger, resentment, and disappointment. So, you know, that's kind of phase one, is just really, you know, I've got to understand, who is this person? Because what I know going into every meeting with couples is they have a relational history and they have a financial history, and those things are interwoven. So I need to get to know that in order to be able to work with them.
I think in any type of couples therapy, there is a hope that insights will drive behavior change that will improve outcomes, some very tangible, some less tangible. What are some of the benefits that you've seen from people who have participated in your process?
Yeah, I think one of the big ones is a sense of shared responsibility for the financial life. And what I mean by that is, you know, sometimes one person's responsible for the household spending and somebody else is responsible for the work. And then, you know, depending, one of those two people is responsible for kind of the long-term visioning. But what happens is you start to get, you know, it's more like a Venn diagram where they're overlapping. It's like, okay, yeah, you might do most of the household shopping, but you know, I need you to also understand that I'm trying to plan for our long-term future. What does that look like? So there's practically a little greater shared overlapping and responsibility. But I think, you know, that's, there's also a deepening of trust and a sense of connection, which for me is really exciting, because I think that's the foundation that allows them to then navigate the future financial decisions ahead of them.
You mentioned four attachment styles. Now I'm going to so oversimplify, you're going to roll your eyes on me here. Are there combinations that are tougher and combinations that are easier? So my hypothesis would be, if both of you have a secure attachment style, it's going to be easier, and that couple may never end up in your office. If both people are anxious, maybe, but maybe the anxious and avoidant is the toughest nut to crack. What would you say about that?
You know, I think the toughest nut to crack actually is, and the, it's the fourth category, which is disorganized attachment. And so they have a very mixed model in their head about the safety of relationships. At least when someone's anxiously or attached or more avoidantly attached, they're more consistent in the way they expect relationships to work. And so it's, we can work with that a little easier. And oftentimes couples that are fighting their way into my office are one's more avoidant, one's more anxiously attached. Well, once in a while, I'll have a secure attached with an anxious or a secure attached with an avoidant. But usually I'm working across anxious and avoidant attachment patterns. Mm.
You, as we've discussed, you work with people directly. You have also written this book. If we were to flip through the pages, if you were to flip through the pages and point our listeners to your most effective piece of advice, the thing that you would just like want blasted from the rooftops when it comes to having productive and loving conversations about money in couples, what would it be?
Oh, that's an incredible question. That's the first time I think I've been asked that question.
That's how I roll. That's how I roll. I will also be asking you to do some mathematical equations. You probably don't get asked those in interviews either, but that's to come.
Yes. Awesome. Well, I'm looking, let me get through that question so I can get to the math questions, because that might be easier. What I have consistently heard from so many people is that it's less the exercises and more my own vulnerability in telling the story about how people can get there. They feel seen and heard in me sharing my story and connecting how our attachment history is playing out in the finances. And so my story is interwoven throughout the whole book. So instead of pointing to one point, I'd say, you know, you kind of got to enjoy the whole book to get the full message.
Well, then here's my supplementary. What is your attachment style?
Anxious.
And what was the moment in which you found, and I'm going to use this word intentionally, when you found and labeled it as that?
Before I answer that, I'll say that when I learned about attachment theory in grad school, I outright rejected it. I hated the idea of it. Really? So it wasn't until postgraduate school that I was in my own therapy work and I was really trying to figure things out. And I finally was like, okay, fine. I will look at this.
I'll try that.
I will try this model. I don't like it. I don't like what it means. Because what for me it meant was like, oh, my parents had a real impact on me and my relational expectations. And I didn't want that to be true. But, you know, as I crossed over that psychological hurdle and have come to terms with that, there's been so much more greater liberation and being able to recognize and name the patterns. And even this week I was talking with my wife and, you know, I'd say, hey, look, I'm having some of these anxious relational thoughts. It's not that you haven't done anything, but I'm just, you know, I'm in that anxious brain right now, you know, and I was able to just ask for some direct affirmation that she loves me, she cares about me. And it was like, felt my brain kind of come back online. Or, you know, if a chiropractor pops your back and you're like, oh yeah, that feels better.
That's it. Thanks.
Yes. You know, so I think when we understand our attachment history, our attachment style, we can be more clear and direct about getting our needs met instead of being kind of backdoor or clingy or abrasive about it.
Being more clear and getting our needs met. Well, that just sums it up so beautifully. Ed, thank you for joining us today.
Bruce, thanks for having me. It's been a pleasure.
Ed Combs is a certified financial planner and therapist. He is the author of The Healthy Love and Money Way, How the Four Attachment Styles Impact Your Financial Well-Being. Stay with us. Coming up next on Moolala, how a home's checkered past might impact its future property value. Clay Jarvis from NerdWallet Canada is here to tell us what to look out for. It sounds like like a haunted house or something. Later, we'll speak with Scarlett Lee Goshawk, CEO of GiftStart, a baby registry that offers a cash fund feature. You do not have to wait an entire week to listen to another episode of Moolala. You can full-on binge it. Just go to moolala.ca anytime or head over to any of the podcast platforms anytime and listen to our episodes. On moolala.ca, you can also search by guest or by topic. On any of the podcast platforms, you can subscribe and leave a review.
You're listening to Moolala, Money Made Simple, with Bruce Ellery on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167.
Welcome back. Moolala, Money Made Simple is brought to you in part by Credit Canada. I am the CEO of the organization, and we are Canada's longest standing nonprofit credit counseling agency. Our mission is to help people get out of debt so they can get back into life. Listen, debt is a brutal reality for millions of Canadians. It starts to pile on for lots and lots of different reasons: job loss, divorce, illness, bad luck, you name it. Our accredited credit counselors are available to help you understand your current financial situation and take you through all your options on how to move forward. And there really are options out there. So go to creditcanada.com. We are nonprofit, as I said. The counseling is free and judgment free. Looking for a home these days is really, really, really difficult. Really difficult. They're hard to find. The stakes are high. The prices are ridiculous. And you really, really don't know what you're getting. Sometimes what you're getting isn't good. But how can you mitigate the risk of buying a house that has a, call it a troubled past? Maybe it's haunted. Maybe, I don't know, used to be a grow op, something like that. Clay Jarvis is a real estate and financial expert at NerdWallet Canada, and he's here to talk about how a home's past might impact property value in the future. Hello there.
Hey, Bruce, how's it going?
When we use this phrase, troubling past, it sounds like a movie preview phrase or something. They're troubling past. What are some of the things that you're talking about? What are some examples?
Sure. Well, a troubled past, the way the Canadian Real Estate Association would describe these properties is that they're stigmatized. So there's not necessarily something that's structurally wrong with them, but there might be something in its past that gives buyers pause about possibly wanting to live there. So it could be a grow up. It could be a murder or a suicide. And as you mentioned, it could even be people who sense some sort of evil or demonic presence in a house and decide they don't really want to pay $800,000 or $1 million for a house where they think they're going to be at some sort of spiritual risk for the rest of their lives.
Right. A ghost is not someone who's necessarily going to show up in a home inspection. Mold, because it was a grow up, might. How does someone find out about some of these challenges that a stigmatized property might have?
Well, it's a great point, because some stigmatizing situations could leave damage on a home. So let's say you're running a grow up and there's mold, or you set up the electricity yourself and now it's a risk to the next people to live there. So factors like that can be found by an inspector. So now, especially at a time when the real estate market has slowed down, getting an inspection is a great way to find out anything that's wrong with the property, whether it's something subjective, like a stigmatized situation, or an actual structural problem. And another thing you can do, if you're concerned that your property might have been involved in some sort of, you know, troublesome situation, Google. You know, type in the address and add the words that you're worried about. You know, if it's 101 West Avenue, type that in and then add drug bust or add fentanyl or add murder and see what comes up. Because if it did take part in a crime or was part of an investigation, there should be some sort of public record out there for you to find.
Whose responsibility is it to do this research? Because it seems to me, and I may be wrong here, but it seems to me that it should be the buyer's agent, given that they're acting on behalf of of you, the buyer? Did they see it that way?
Well, because there are no real legal guidelines about this, unless you're in Quebec. In Quebec, it is the seller's responsibility to disclose anything that might be a concern to the buyer. But in the rest of Canada, it's a bit of a gray area. So it really starts with the seller. If the seller knows there is something about this property that might cause a person not to want to live there or to offer less, it's really just the ethical thing to do is to disclose this. Disclose it either directly to potential buyers or to your buyer's agent or seller's agent, and have them disclose this to either potential buyers or those buyers' agents. It's really up to everybody involved to make sure that the information available is made available.
I have no idea on where the law, the line is legally here. There are some things that seem logical, like you can't just put up new drywall to deal with a chronic mold issue in the house. That would feels like that would be cheating. But where does the buyer have legal recourse to say, wait a sec, you didn't tell me, fill in the blank?
Well, that's just it. Because this hasn't been codified in law, if there is a situation where a buyer takes the seller to court, there's really no precedent that you can lean on to say, okay, well, you did this, so now I'm entitled to this. Here's an interesting example that's actually going on right now. Some of your listeners might be familiar with the basketball player Shai Gilgeous-Alexander, who's a really great point guard for the Oklahoma City Thunder. He recently bought a mansion, I think it was about $8.4 million in Burlington. And the person he bought it from just happened to be this 24-year-old crypto scammer who made off with $40 million worth of investors' money. And shortly after Shai moved into this place, well, there's people coming here looking for their money. So, you know, in instances like that, you know, there is an actual lingering danger for, you know, your next tenant. So if that's a situation, that is something you definitely need to disclose because there's a danger there for the next resident. And in a case like that, you know, being taken to court, you know, regardless of what happens, actually being sued seems like a pretty reasonable outcome to expect.
There's no mathematical equation here, but it would seem to follow that if you knew you were buying a stigmatized property, it would trade at a discount versus comparable properties of similar size and location. If you're willing to take that risk, how do you negotiate the best deal? Pull up all the Google articles and, you know, have them laminated and provided to the sellers?
Well, I think that would be a great idea if you could provide a lot of evidence that speaks to the questionable value of this property. Maybe that would work in your favor. But when we're talking about stigma, whether it's a house or whether it's, you know, human behavior in general, it's all relative. And what's a stigma to me might not be a stigma to somebody else. And in a tight real estate market like we have in Toronto, you know, a buyer might just think, well, if you don't want it, somebody else will.
Yeah.
So you can't really expect to play hardball with these things that don't have concrete results.
It's interesting because the question of property home value, so stigmatized property and the effect that that has on the value, really depends whether you're coming at this from the perspective of the seller or the buyer, doesn't it?
Well, precisely. I think the stigma would impact buyers a lot more. I mean, if you're the seller, you know, you've already gotten your use out of the property and now you're trying to get your money back. So you're probably going to downplay it or at least downplay it in your mind. Whereas if you're a buyer, well, you're assuming this property's history. And, you know, depending on how much weight you give that history, it could really impact your enjoyment of this home.
What do you have any sense for what the sector requires of its agents? Is there like something in the code of conduct that would put them offside if they didn't disclose? It just feels like so much is laid at the feet of the buyers and the sellers when there is an entire, you know, set of professionals who know the neighborhoods. They may well know much more detail about the seller's story.
Absolutely. The Canadian Real Estate Association, in cases like these, is always pushing for more openness and more transparency. So if you are a seller's agent and you know that something has happened in this home, you are encouraged to disclose it. It's just really the ethical thing to do. And it's the easiest way to avoid problems in the future.
There was a period of time, and maybe we're still in that period, where people would forego the home inspection because there were, you know, 15 bidders who were all ponying up, you know, cash. Are we at a time in our history now where the importance and the relevance of a home inspection has returned?
Well, I'd argue that the relevance of a home inspection has never wavered, and it's always something that a buyer should get. But right now, with the market as slow as it is, with mortgage rates as high as they are, it really has added a lot of breathing room and a lot of reflection time to the market. And it is a time where you should really take advantage to learn as much as you can about a property before putting in a bid. You know, it's not going to be like this for much longer. So it's a good time to exercise that kind of patience.
What if you were on the market for a house? Would you be even willing to look at a property that had a past? Would you, like, I don't know, make it a podcast or something?
Well, I guess it would have to be a pretty interesting stigma to turn it into a podcast. Like, I like to tell myself that, you know, if a house came on the market and it was marked down by 200K because somebody had been, you know, slaughtered in some sort of satanic ritual, that I'd be able to just, you know, laugh it off. But who knows? Until you're really in that position, you don't know how it's going to make you feel in your gut. And you don't know how you're going to feel like a month or a year from now. And you might buy a house that nobody wants to visit you in. So yeah, for me personally, I would look more at the bottom line and just know that a property's house or a property's history is not my history. And that history starts anew as soon as I buy it. That's what I would tell myself anyways.
I would tell myself that too. You and I both spend a good portion of our time writing for a living. So I feel like you and I could both create a new parallel narrative. It's just, we'd have to indoctrinate the neighbors into buying into that narrative, right?
Well, indoctrinating people is so much fun. That's why it's
so much fun. So much fun. Well, really interesting thought. I thankfully own a home that doesn't have a troubled past, and I'm not on the market for anything in the future, but hey, it could be bargain tip number one. Clay, thank you for joining us today.
Anytime. Thanks a lot.
Clay Jarvis, real estate and financial expert at NerdWallet Canada. And yeah, the probability of you looking at a house that is classified as stigmatized, it's probably pretty low, but still something you should be aware of nonetheless.
Hi, it's me, your dad. Look, we need to talk. This isn't working. The missed payments, the collection calls, and all those sleepless nights. We need nonprofit debt counseling, and I found the perfect place. Credit Canada Debt Solutions. They're non-judgmental, 100% confidential. They'll negotiate with creditors and even stop interest. Don't you want to rebuild your credit? You deserve better.
Break up with debt. Visit creditcanada.com.
Stay with us. Coming up later, raising a child is really, really, really expensive. Instead of receiving physical gifts when that kid comes to you, maybe you want cash. There is a baby registry that offers a cash fund feature. It's called Gift Start, and its CEO, Scarlett Lee Goshawk, is going to talk about how that particular feature works. But first, how fraudsters are targeting shoppers and how you can prevent yourself from becoming a victim. Julie Kuzmic from Equifax Canada is here to share her tips. If you like light lifestyle shows, and who doesn't? Come on, they're so fun. I am the money columnist for one called Cityline. In fact, it is the longest running daytime show in North America, and it's hosted by none other than Tracy Moore. So if you go to cityline.tv, you can check out all sorts of segments, you know, stuff I do, but more interesting things.
We all believe in the possibilities of tomorrow. And at Easy Financial, we're here to help you every step of the way. If the banks aren't an option, we can help get you approved for a loan in as little as 10 minutes. And with our personal, home equity, and auto loans, you can choose the loan that's right for you, so you can start rebuilding your credit for a better tomorrow. Apply today without affecting your credit score at easyfinancial.com or at over 400 locations and find out how much you can qualify for. Easy Financial. better tomorrows.
We all of us, every single one of us, need to be aware of what is going on in the world of fraud. Why? Because they're very creative people and they would like some of your money. But the probability of them getting some of your money will be lessened if you listen to this conversation and take action based on what you hear. That is because we're going to talk about what the fraudsters are thinking about and doing these days and give you some tips on how to protect yourself. Julie Kuzmic is Senior Compliance Officer, Consumer Advocacy at Equifax Canada. Hello there.
Hello.
When we focus on a topic like this, does it do more to, does it improve or negate your view about the future of our world? I always think, wow, these fraudsters are getting so creative. How can we compete?
Yeah, I guess if we could harness that power for good, then
great.
Maybe we could attack something real like climate change.
Yeah, great idea. Love that. They are getting creative. They are not tackling climate change. They are tackling our wallets. What are some ways in which fraud has changed over the years? What are some things that you're noticing?
Well, as the technology advances, of course, so do the tools and abilities of the fraudsters out there. But one of the things that I think people forget is that fraudsters will take the easiest path. And sometimes that just means your bank statements that you forgot to recycle or you forgot to shred and threw them in
before you recycled.
Right. And it's not always these super high-tech Bitcoin-centered fraud schemes that are getting people. Sometimes it's just forgetting your wallet in the cart at Costco and being unlucky enough that the person who found it tried to do something with your identity instead of doing the right thing and turning the wallet in.
You have done a survey to sort of get a pulse for how Canadians are thinking about, feeling about fraud these days. What stood out to you in that survey?
It stood out to me that close to half of the respondents said that they feel more vulnerable to fraud around the holidays. And I think some of that is related to the fact that people prefer to use credit cards for a lot of their holiday shopping. So we saw 2/3 of the respondents saying that. And that even more, 70% feel they need to do more to protect themselves. So I think people are aware that if you're doing more transactions, and of course, a lot of online shopping is happening around this time of year, then there are more opportunities for fraudsters to intercept a transaction or otherwise try to get their hands on your sensitive data.
You have some tips. I love some tips. Beginning with only shop with trusted retailers and be careful at checkout. Is this tip predominantly focused on our online behavior, or does this matter too when we're just, you know, walking the high street and wandering into a small business?
Well, at least if we were walking the high street, we'd probably be in the UK where there are actually are.
You picked up on that. I was thinking that was a really bougie reference for me to call, you know, my local downtown a high street. And there'd be like a Boots or a Marks and Spencer on every corner.
Well, I'm all for that. I love those two shops. But anyway, it's more a reference to online shopping. So the type of scam that we see here is where someone is scrolling through one of their feeds, let's say it's Instagram, and you see an ad pop up for some brand that you like. Maybe it's like Lancome Cosmetics or something of high-end leather goods. And it looks like, wow, this Black Friday sale is amazing. And instead of going separately to the retailer's website to make sure that this is a legitimate ad from the actual retailer, you're clicking on that ad, which may not be who they say they are. And when you go through their fake website and their fake purchasing process and you click on submit order, they are getting not only your credit card data, but a chunk of money that you have just transmitted to them. So you're doubly out. One is you're not getting the goods that you thought you just purchased. And secondly, unfortunately, you've just fed this data to fraudsters.
Another tip is being careful about what information you share on social media. What would be some examples of that? And are my kitten and cat videos and photos putting me at risk? Because it's almost worth it because my cat's that cute.
I believe that. And although on behalf of Equifax, I'm in no position to comment on
the cuteness of my cat. Okay. All right.
Right. But fair. On a personal level, cat videos all day, every day, for sure. Now, this one is a bit old. It's as old as the internet of don't share too much information online. But some of that is just, if you're saying, I can't wait in 6 hours from now, I'll be on a plane heading somewhere warm for the holidays, you can be letting people know, therefore, my house is currently empty. And it might not be a break-in, as we were discussing. It could be as simple as, oh, those recycle bins outside that person's house, I'm going to go take a look because maybe I can find a bank statement and they're less likely to be home to notice that I'm rifling through their garbage cans.
Passwords are a big deal. I've been on a password manager for years and years now, and as frustrating as two-factor authentication is, I am a big believer. What's your hygiene around passwords? Do you walk the talk here?
I feel like you're looking into my soul might not like what you're seeing.
Get ready.
I sign up for two-factor authentication everywhere I can. So as a reminder, of course, for your listeners, that's where you're giving your cell number and you're asking for a text or a phone call with a one-time use PIN to be delivered so that when you enter your password onto your, say, online banking, they won't let you in unless you are also providing this PIN that is only valid for a period of, say, 10 minutes. I find that to be a bit of a hassle too, but then when I really think about it, it's probably adding less than 5 seconds to me signing in. So it's absolutely worth it because if somebody has figured out my password, the chances that they have my cell phone at the same time are a lot lower. So that is really something that is important to do where you get the opportunity to.
You also, and no surprise, recommend that people check their credit reports on a regular basis. This is kind of after the fact, but you would want to be sure that you catch the fraud as quickly as possible. You and I have talked before about my own experience with identity theft and how long that took to unwind things. When people do look at those the credit reports and the scores that go alongside that, what should they be looking for?
One of the most important things is just looking for accounts that you don't recognize. There's an inquiry section on your credit reports, and that's, of course, both Equifax and TransUnion. Everybody can get free credit reports online from both the credit bureaus today. So this is not going to take any money. It'll just take a couple minutes of your time. If you see an account or an inquiry onto your credit report that isn't yours, that's where you want to start asking questions. Now, that could simply be that somebody with a similar name and address has this account and it mistakenly appeared on your credit report instead of theirs. So sometimes it's a simple mistake that's easy to reverse, but other times it is actually somebody using your information, trying to or having successfully opened a new credit account in your name.
And what do you do? You see that on the report, you pick up the phone and say what?
You want to call the credit bureaus, both Equifax and TransUnion, even if you only see it on one, because you can put a fraud alert on each of your credit reports for free. And that will help slow down any future transactions. You give them your cell number and any retailer or lender that receives an application in your name is supposed to call you at that number that you've provided in order to make sure that it is actually you. So that's one of the first things you want to do. And that's also free. But of course, you want to follow up with those accounts. If it's at a bank or a credit card issuer, you want to make sure they know that this is a fraudulent account, get it locked, and get their fraud team looking into it so that you can start the process of reversing any charges that may have been incurred on that account and getting it shut down.
Everyone needs to sort of manage their expectations too, not only in terms of how long it takes to resolve a situation like that, but the other things that mysteriously can pop up over the course of months and years. For example, I went to register for another credit score service just to try it out. And I couldn't get in. I couldn't log on. It wouldn't work. It didn't work. And it was because of that fraud alert on my account. So I think it was great that I was protected in that way, but I didn't know that it would prevent other certain actions, my ability to do other certain things.
It's really interesting to hear you had that experience. I wouldn't have thought it should have worked that way. And I'm sure you didn't think so either.
I did not. Yes. And of course, I went all the way to, the king and queen of the financial services company to say, why can't I sign up for this thing? And they finally found, oh, it's because you've got this thing on your account. So if you were to sum up in one sentence, the wisdom of the ages on reducing the risk that you will be a victim of fraud, what would you say?
Be aware, pay attention, shred your documents, and look at your credit reports. You can do it for free. There are a lot of cases where people don't find out about some kind of fraud that has taken place until they're trying to finalize that car loan or lease or get that mortgage renewal in place or that first home buyer's mortgage. And they're finding out that they're not a good prospect because there's an item in collections on their credit report, which doesn't even belong to them. You don't want to be finding that stuff out when you're in one of those high pressure situations. So it is worth just spending a couple minutes and making sure that you're in the clear.
When you started your answer there, I actually thought you were going to say a haiku poem. It sounded like that's where you were going. Shred your documents, thinking, running over the lazy brook, shredding. Something like that. Would you work on that for the next time we speak and you can do your comments in haiku?
I will. I will definitely be focused on that. And I look forward to bringing you back further credit wisdom in the form of a haiku.
Yes, please. Julie Kuzmic, great to talk to you.
Thanks, Bruce.
Julie Kuzmic is the Senior Compliance Officer, Consumer Advocacy at Equifax Canada. She was here to talk about the latest in fraud prevention and the things that you could do, should do, must do to keep your files and information as safe as possible. Stay with us. Coming up, a baby registry called Gift Start that offers a cash fund feature. So yeah, you can register for, I don't know, a bassinet and a bottle warmer, but you can also register to save some money for your new child in lots of different categories. CEO Scarlett Lee Goshawk is going to be here to talk about how this could be a solution, or at least a part of the solution, for expectant parents trying to navigate this very high cost of living that most people are experiencing these days. If you would like to stay up to date on the latest and greatest that Moolala has to offer, then sign up for our newsletter. Super simple. You go to moolala.ca and you put in your email address. And then once a month, you get a newsletter with a summary of things that we have been talking about across all the different areas where we focus. CBC Radio, here on Sirius XM, Cityline, BNN Bloomberg, Global, blah, blah, blah. We've also got some tips and tricks to help you get a handle on your money. Moolala, Money Made Simple, is brought to you in part by MNP Debt, specializing in personal bankruptcy, consumer proposals, and debt help. They're Canada's largest consumer insolvency firm, and they've been around for 60 years, 60 years of experience helping Canadians break the cycle of debt. MNP has more than 80 local licensed insolvency trustees serving more than 240 resident satellite offices across the country. Your first step towards a debt-free future, sitting down with one of those folks, one of those licensed insolvency trustees, for a free confidential consultation. MNP Debt, life-changing debt solutions that work. their website, mnpdebt.ca, mnpdebt.ca. Gift registries have been around for a really, really long time. I remember like a long time ago going into a store, and I think they might have even had a zapper, and you could zap things and add them to a gift registry. So whether that's getting married or having a baby or some other event, it's a pretty convenient way for guests of an event or people in your life who want to buy a gift to get you something that you actually want and need. As we think about our life today, the cost of living is ridiculous, and the cost of living for raising children is ridiculous. So there's a new registry and a new method of gift giving that we want to talk about today on Moolala. It's called Gift Start, and it is a baby registry platform that has a cash fund feature. The company's CEO, Scarlett Lee Goshawk, is here to talk about how it works. Hello there.
Hi, Bruce. Thank you so much for having me today.
So gift registries, as I say, been around forever. You choose the thing, someone buys the thing. Sometimes they even buy a part of the thing. But you decided to add a cash fund feature. Why?
Well, actually, that's a really good question. Like you mentioned earlier, gift registry has been around for decades. But when you really think about this, from its back in the days, from its brick and mortar store form to now an online version of that, the landscape really hasn't changed. But our needs today, especially as young parents, have changed drastically, especially, you know, with the current increasing cost in child rearing expenses, inflation, house affordability, we recognize the importance of the financial support that's more than ever that are needed on young parents. Hence, we launched a cash fund. So what we do really is, it's really a feature that's to facilitate financial contributions for parents to kind of alleviate some of the financial strain on young parents. Really, when you think about this, when it's never fun to ask for financial assistance. People always ask you, hey, what do you want for a new baby? You never want to say, just give me cash. And then you end up with all these, you know, swaddle blankets. I think personally, I've gotten 16 swaddle blankets for my daughter. Nobody needs that much wastefulness, right? So really what parents need today are the financial support. So by incorporating cash fund into a part of their baby registry, you are able to ask cash contribution in a more polite and graceful and tasteful manner, really.
What I think is really neat, I mean, the idea I like, of course, it goes to, you know, how I operate in the world. But what I like about the way you've set it up is you've kind of branded the different gifts that people could contribute to. So I'm just going to go through them. Create your own, so you can make one up. Nursery dreams, tiny steps, big dreams. Diapers Delight Fund. There is nothing delightful about a diaper, says someone who worked on Pampers for Procter & Gamble for 2 years. Tiny Tot Tender Care. Parental wellness and support, and then gear up for baby. Tell us about how you came up with those different categories for cash funds.
Yeah, absolutely. I think when you look at every family's, their situations are so unique. So with our platform, we kind of pre-named and some of the cash fund that's been pre-created on the essentials, such as nursery that you said, the gear funds, and also the parental support. People don't really often think, hey, you know what? No newborns that needs care, also parents needs care. And to create your own. So the platform is really highly flexible and customizable. You can preset a goal for the amount that you want to reach for the specific use of the funds, or you can leave it uncapped. So it's really designed to be met with the ever-changing needs of the family.
The one that is sort of outside, not like the others, is the parental wellness and support one. We're supposed to be selfless as parents. And yet that one, if I had a friend who had that one, that would be the one that I would direct my money to, because I remember vividly how brutal those first couple of years were.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's really designed for that. I think when you have a baby, you tend to be so selfless, right? All your focus is on is caring for the newborn. But sometimes you forget, you know, parents need support too, especially with somebody who, as a mom who went through 9 months of pregnancy, who's in the first 12 weeks of postpartum, what we call fourth trimester. To, you know, either it's pelvic floor therapy or even just have a night nanny that you'd be able to go take a shower, have a few hours of sleep is so important. But something a lot of time you don't really want to put on as a gift, naming it, hey, help me with my pelvic floor therapy, you're helping me with my lactation. it's embarrassing, awkward to ask. So to kind of group it under a wellness fund, that's a really just, once again, it's a really tasteful and courteous way of asking for the financial support that you can kind of put into discretionary use.
How does GiftStart make money on the cash fund piece? Because I get it. If you're selling, you know, a crib online and people are registering for a crib as a retailer, there'd be a margin there. How do you make money on the cash fund feature?
That's a really good question, Bruce. We actually don't make a lot from the cash fund. It's really just an added-on feature from a platform to really support the Canadian parents. So like many cash fund that's available in the market, actually when you take a look at all the gift registry, we're the only Canadian cash fund that's available. All the other cash funds are US. So we charge the same percentage of a processing fee. It's a very, very small percentage. But in our case, it's a Canadian dollar versus US dollar, which are more friendly on the Canadian parents' pocket. Other than that, it's just a regular processing fee that's being taken by Square, which is a payment processor that we use leverage for the payment intake, and it's very safe and secure.
What do you think about our culture in this at this moment in time when it comes to cash fund? Because I was married almost 20 years ago, and we registered for a bunkie at our little tiny cottage. We didn't need a thing. We were living in New York City. We were in our early 30s. Like, we did not need anything. And people made contributions to that bunkie, and it was very special for us, and we love it. But it was certainly not really done back in those days. Is this done more often? Is this more socially acceptable?
We are seeing a more of an upward trend in people doing cash fund for their baby registry. It's wildly popular in the wedding space, as you mentioned earlier. We're seeing, you know, pretty much every wedding we've been invited to are doing a honeymoon fund or people saving for their first home fund. With baby, it's less, but we are doing, because the financial strain on young parents are just, you know, people are met with a host of challenges these days. So I think there is an upward trend. And since the launch of a cash fund, we're seeing 95% of registry that I created has cash fund incorporated as their part of the registry.
What else can you tell us in terms of the data? Like, do you have an approximate value that cash funds raise per user, or is there a particular account that people are gravitating toward more often than others?
The amount is honestly too large to vary. We are seeing as little as $25 that's being contributed into the Diaper Delight Fund that you love so much, to you know, more of a large lump sum, mostly coming from parents to give it to their children to have another child. But one thing that we have seen on the back end is the Gear Up for Baby and Nursery Dreams that are really popular as a preset cash fund.
Yeah, I'd like to put an asterisk beside that one and tell everybody, buy crappy stuff, because you're only going to use it for about 5 minutes. So don't go for a used thing. But no one wants to hear that. They want the perfect nursery and the perfect thing. Let me ask you just before we go here, one of the other areas in which there's a huge opportunity for people to save for their kid is with education savings. Is the cash fund feature a way that you can start to get things going on a registered education savings plan?
Yes, absolutely. We are actually seeing an uptake in people creating, you know, what we created here is called college fund, but really people, I'm seeing people naming them for even daycare expenses. So thinking about, this is such a nice way even for this platform to be used for milestone birthdays, Christmas, you know, any kind of gift occasions, you can create an RSP fund for people to contribute cash into it. And start saving.
Really interesting. Really interesting stuff. Scarlett, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you so much again for having me. It's been a pleasure.
Scarlett Lee Goshawk is the CEO of GiftStart, and she joined me to talk about this cash fund feature on their gift registry, which is a really easy way for you to contribute financially to the upbringing of a child in your life without having to get them yet another swaddling blanket. Or in my case, shoes. People were buying shoes for newborns. Made absolutely no sense. I don't know why they did that. That is it for our show for today. A big thanks to our sponsors, Credit Canada, the first and longest standing nonprofit credit counseling agency in the country, and by MNP Debt, specializing in personal bankruptcy, consumer proposals, and debt help. If you have a thought for us, a story idea, some feedback, a question, our email address is ask@moolala.ca. ask@moolala.ca. To stay up to date on all things Moolala, sign up for our newsletter at our website and subscribe to the show on whatever podcast platform you favor. On social media, I'm @BruceCellery on X, Bruce Cellery Moolala on Facebook. Thank you for listening and have a great day.